Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. And by the way, we're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, the home of WIL AM, FM, and TV, made possible by a gift from Alice and Robert Campbell. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about workplace issues. It is Monday morning, and here we are at work. How do we make the best of that? How do we balance our work life with everything else we've got going in the world? And it seems to me that since September 11th, a lot of us are dealing with a lot of stress, maybe a lot of extra paying attention to things, and maybe reevaluating our priorities in many ways. Anyway, that's the way it seems to me, and we'll talk about that and whatever else you have on your mind with regard to workplace issues. Our guest is someone we like to call our workplace issues expert in residence. We give people these honorary titles since we can't pay them anything. Tom Schenck is with us. He is with the Schenck Development Group in Champaign, located in Champaign. Tom Schenck coaches individuals, teams, and organizations to help them become more effective communicators, leaders, and contributors. He's worked with thousands of people in a wide range of large and small organizations to help them improve their productivity in the changing environments they face. And Tom has worked from his office in Champaign for 13 years, but serves clients from coast to coast. And we're glad to have Tom Schenck with us during this hour as we talk about work and other issues. You are welcome to join the conversation. If you have questions or comments on the topic, those are welcome. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, the rest of the states via the internet, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, anytime during this hour, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Tom, good morning.
Well, good morning. It's interesting that you start off just with this question of Monday morning and looking at workplace and rest of your life balance, because that really is a big problem for a lot of folks. There's some interesting research that shows that Monday at 9 o'clock is the most common time for
heart attacks. Right.
And so we're at 10 o'clock. We're past the danger zone, I guess. But we do have to really think about what does that mean and why does that happen? I think one big reason is because people maybe don't have their priorities, as you had indicated. They don't have them quite straight, or they're not really sure what they want to get out of work. And that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Well, I think also, and certainly feel free to continue on the theme that you just established, but another theme, it seems, is that we're now also busy, that the weekend just isn't long enough to take care of everything. So you feel like, well, Friday night is the beginning of the weekend. Maybe, you know, not everybody works Monday through Friday 9 to 5, so there are different considerations. But just in general, at least for a lot of people, you know, the weekend goes by so quickly and suddenly it's Monday morning and you go, ugh.
You know, one in both at home and at work, I think a great place to start is just by asking, wherever you are, what's the difference between the things I want to do and the things I have to do? And a lot of times just asking that and listing those two things out on one list is a great way to start, get a little more control and get a little more sense of balance. A lot of times we spend a lot of time doing things that we feel we have to do, but we don't really want to do. Automatically, that's going to leave us feeling a little more stressed. If, on the other hand, we start to look at the things that we want to do for different reasons, maybe it's because it's going to help us move forward with the boss and get a better relationship going. Maybe it's because it's going to give us a sense of accomplishment when we finish that one project at home that's been kind of hanging over our heads, you know, getting the garden cleaned up for the year, getting the stuff down from the attic for holiday things, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. If we just go ahead and get that one thing done, that might be all we need to feel a little bit more balanced, feel a little sense of accomplishment. But it starts with that question. What is it that I have to do? What is it that I want to do? And why for each?
How do you go about evaluating that then?
I think literally it's a question of looking at some of those big priorities. You started off with the idea that after September 11th, all of us are rethinking some priorities. I think that might be one of the positive outcomes of all of these current events going on. If we do, as individuals, as families, as companies, and as a nation, start looking at our priorities, we might find it's a lot easier to make some of these, well, what we thought were hard decisions before September 11th. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the direction that we need to be moving into a little bit. Sometimes it is just a question of asking, what is the big purpose of what I'm doing today, whether it's at home or at work, and what is it that I'm trying to accomplish with this? Is this really a priority, or is this something that maybe is not as important as I thought it was even just a few weeks ago?
Mm-hmm. See, that's an interesting question, because a lot of times when we say to ourselves, boy, you know, my life is somewhat confused and things are difficult because I have so much to do. And there seems to be all these considerations we have about how we're doing things and what we have to do, this feeling of obligation that, you know, it's almost like you can't break off from the path that you're on. And then something happens suddenly to give us a different perspective on that. And suddenly it's clear that, you know, we can change. We can take a different path.
You know, it's, I guess, a little simple psychological principle that oftentimes the way people take that step back and look at their lives is only after a major external event. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you need, well, okay, we had one. Now here's everybody's chance. Some people, and I think when you look at what it takes to be successful at home or on the job, some people are good at doing that on a regular basis without that big external thing. Now, I don't think it's a question of good or bad either way, but the thing is, if you're not one of those folks who does it just as part of your normal lifestyle, where you take stock every 6 months or every 3 months or once a year, and you need an external trigger, well, fine. But you've got to go ahead and find that trigger and use it when it presents itself. September 11th was a big trigger for a lot of people, and I think it's an important one. Many people just like the end of the year. If you take a time to look at your big goals, when we get here to New Year's, December 31st, January 1st, great time to just think about your goals. Some people do it more like on the financial end of year. If you're used to working with deadlines and such in your organization, that might be another good time to do it. Some people will do this when there's a birth in the family or a death in the family. Mm-hmm. All of those are good times. But the thing is, we have to have that time to sit down and look at our priorities. And I'm going to make a very simple suggestion that most people miss, and that is you got to do it on paper. You know, you had asked earlier, how do you make that list? How do you decide?
Sure.
It's easy. You have to think on paper. We know so much about people who are the most effective in any area of life, and they always think on paper. Just simply starting off the day, take 5 minutes and write down five things you want to accomplish at home or five things you want to accomplish on your job. Just doing that will help you get organized and will help you start to think about what is important, what are my priorities for the day. At the end of the day, you may not finish all five items, but if you start off with that list, you're probably going to more consistently finish the things that you want to do and the things you have to do and feel less stressed at it.
Well, let me write this down. Now, is that true? Is there research to show that people who consistently accomplish their objectives actually do write lists of things to do?
Yes, a huge amount of research. There's a great book called How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci that was out just a year or 2 years ago. And I guess they start looking at people, even some of the ancients were into writing things down. And da Vinci never went anywhere without his journals. Mm-hmm. And we know da Vinci is not just a great artist, but also a great scientist, a great philosopher, a great writer in a lot of ways. And he really kind of had the model. And all you simply have to do is he carried around a journal. And mm-hmm. even that is enough. And in his journal, he would sketch faces, he would jot down snippets of conversation, he would write down ideas, he would write down observations of the natural world or other things he saw going on around him. And over the years, he would go back to these journals back again and again and again and examine and re-examine what he found in the world. And that's what helped him accomplish as much as he had. Now, you take that up through the current, and we find that over and over again, the most successful people are simply the people who will write down what's important to me? What are my values? What do I want to accomplish in the next 3 hours? What do I want to accomplish in the next 3 months, the next 3 years, the next 3 decades? Those are the people who accomplish more. Mm-hmm. I think we could take a page from Samuel Goldwyn, who said a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's written on.
Right.
And it's the same thing with our own personal goals and priorities. If we don't write it down, the message to our brain is this really isn't that important. Mm-hmm. If we write it down, though, the message is this is important, even if we never, ever show it to anyone else.
You mentioned a word that I think is really key in discussing work, family, other life issues, and that's values. And I think that a lot of times we forget about the role of values in everything we do and, you know, again, find ourselves on that treadmill wondering why the heck we have to run so fast.
Values is one of those areas that we really do need to take a look at, but most of us are never trained on how to. We get a lot of our values that are just instilled inside of us from our parents, our early educational experiences, our early experiences in whatever religious organization that we might have grown up in, our friends, of course. When we get into the workplace, we're kind of instilled with values that come from the job. But a lot of times people don't question, well, do I agree with those values? Are those values helping me get to my goals? Are those values harming me? Are those values things that I really want to embrace? And if we do get to that stage, then sometimes we forget to ask the next question, which is, How do I do it? How do I actually live that value? If I say that my family is important to me, how am I proving that every day in some kind of tangible action? If I am, then it is a true value for me. If I'm not, then, well, I don't really have that value. One test that I recommend to people quite often, if you want to know what your values are, a very simple way to do it. Look at your checkbook and look at your day calendar. Where you spend your time and where you spend your money are two of the surest indicators of what your real values are. If you say you value your health, for example, but you have dominoes on your speed dial, that may indicate that maybe you don't value health quite as much as you think. But if you see that every day you do a little something to improve your body, well, that shows that you really do value that. Mm-hmm. If you value getting ahead at work, but every day you hang around with the people who are not good producers, you hang around with the people who do not have anything good to say about your organization, it's going to be a lot harder for you to live that value. If you're hanging around with people, however, who are also interested in making a good contribution on the job, if you're hanging around with people who are interested in giving good service to your customers, whether those are inside or outside your organization, wow, then you have a great opportunity to live that value of moving ahead in your career.
When you work with people, the clients that you deal with, and you talk about these things and you do this sort of values audit, what do people find? I mean, do people find that they're, you know, not really conforming with the values that they say they are, you know, for? And then what do they do from there?
I work with people in two different ways. One is we work with groups, so that might be an intact work team, mm-hmm. or sometimes it's a whole department or division of an organization. And one of the interesting things is I often find that there's a lot of agreement about what the values are, mm-hmm. and people don't realize that they're in so much agreement. The disagreements that they see day to day are not in the values, but in how each person supports that value. Mm-hmm. I had one example of a team where there were two people in conflict, and it was starting to tear apart the whole team. And the question was professionalism. Each accused the other of not being professional. Well, it turns out that one person thought professional was I show up from 8 to 5, I stay there at the job at my desk, I work consistently, I don't waste time, and when the day is done, I leave. That's good use of company's time. Mm-hmm. The other person felt that, well, to be a good team member and be professional, I've got to socialize with my teammates, I've got to get to know what their projects are, help them do brainstorming and problem solving, I'm going to stay maybe an hour or an hour and a half late each day. The interesting thing was, in the end, they both got the same amount of work done, but their work styles, the particular behaviors that they used to express that value, were very different. That's what created the conflict. We worked it out where we started to define what professionalism means to each of them, and they saw that they were each professional, they were just professional in different ways. And a lot of times the problem is the lack of definition. And that's true at family life, too. Every parent, I think, starts off with the notion that our value is to raise a happy child, a healthy child. Now, what that means to one person and what that means to the other parent might be two very, very different things, and that's where conflict at home comes in. So I think because we're all from the same culture, we all live in the same society, we're all are surrounded by so many similar kinds of experiences or influences, we actually have a lot of values in common. And we tend to gravitate toward people who have similar values. It's in the particular expression, the day-to-day support for those values, that sometimes it breaks down, and it looks like we really have more conflict than we do.
A lot of times, very creative people, teams of, you know, whether they're people doing academic research or science or engineering or, you know, law, whatever, people are very dedicated. They work very hard. And I see them get into conflict with each other over these very things you're talking about, the definitions of professionalism or the work styles that people have, different work styles and so forth. And people get very intolerant toward each other over these things. And perhaps, you know, egos and ambitions and careers, are, you know, throw those things into the mix and you have, you know, a situation that, you know, there's going to be conflict. How do you go about sorting out some of that conflict, I think, is probably inevitable, not to say that it's good or even bad necessarily, but sometimes conflict can be very destructive.
It can be, and really, this is some of the same sort of issue where it's when we don't talk about what are some of these things going on. If we try to pretend conflict doesn't exist, then it's always going to be harder to go through. In fact, one of the things that I found in both my research and my experience working with teams is that any relationship that does not manage conflict well is doomed to failure. Inability to manage conflict is a predictor of relationship failure. And as far as I can tell, that's true whether it's a marriage, whether it's two friends on the playground, whether it's two people who are supposed to be coworkers, whether it's two nations not working together. It's inability to manage conflict that predicts relationship failure. So we have to start by that premise that we have to look at conflict. Conflict is going to exist because differences of opinion exist. Even identical twins have differences of opinion, differences in preferences, differences in the way they might approach a particular task or activity. There's nothing wrong with that. But when we don't acknowledge that conflict can exist, that's when we often have problems. That's when some of those behaviors go underground and we see inappropriate expression. Parents out there will know the phrase or the term acting out. And a lot of times that's exactly what's happening on the job. Mm-hmm. It's employees, adults, are simply acting out. They can't deal with their conflict because we don't have any ground rules for managing conflict. So they act out. It comes out in one way or another, usually a way that's inappropriate.
Well, see, this is a very interesting area because I think that we have different attitudes about conflict and whether it is good or bad. I think some of us feel that any conflict is to be avoided, that there's this attitude that conflict by itself is dysfunctional, destructive, and there shouldn't be conflict. On the other hand, there are people who feel, whether it's a personal style or maybe they've just learned a different lesson about it, that a lot of times conflict, you have to have conflict where you have different points of view. Those points of view have to be expressed so that we can, I don't know the metaphor to use here, duke it out or something, and come to a better understanding and a better scenario after the conflict. And I wonder what you might say about that. Is conflict by itself something to be afraid of?
No, conflict is definitely not something to be afraid of. It really is the way issues come out in relationships so we can resolve them. If we never deal with those issues, the relationship is diminished. We interact behind masks and we never really reveal our true selves, our true needs, our true concerns, or our true strengths. We can't really give everything because we're hiding that part that we're afraid might lead to conflict. So conflict is important in a relationship, but we have to handle it responsibly. You had mentioned one of the big problems is just the messages that we all grow up with about conflict are somewhat schizophrenic. We have, probably everyone has heard from their parents, be nice. Just be nice. Don't say anything. Don't rock the boat. If you had brothers or sisters, you probably had that time when you had to shake hands and make up, even if you knew deep in your hearts neither one of you felt like making up. We get these messages that say you have to be nice. Now, on the other hand, part of the American consciousness is, the cowboy. It's when somebody disagrees with you, you meet them down on Main Street at high noon, and you stand up for yourself, and you fight for right, and all of those other messages that, winning World War II single-handedly, these are some of our national myths that we all grow up with as well. So the individual has to kind of figure out, well, when is this a time for me to make up and to kind of go along, and when is this a time for me to stand up for myself? And that's a big challenge for a lot of people. Many people will also look at their own personal histories. If I'm on the job and when I was a young pup, I tried to stand up to my boss and I got slapped down hard. Even 30 years later, I might be a little less willing to stand up to a boss because that early experience might have been fairly traumatic. On the other hand, if I had a boss when I had my first or second or third job who was very open and willing to listen to ideas, and I might have presented that same kind of issue, and they might have responded in a totally different way, now all of a sudden my background experience is positive. And so for the rest of my career, I might be much more likely to bring that up. You also mentioned just about personality style. Sometimes some people are confronters and some people are evaders, and that is one of the many dimensions of personality. So some people will be very hesitant to approach conflict. Unfortunately, one of the things we know from a great deal of research is people who consistently avoid conflict are often more stressed. It's one of those situations where a lot of times holding it in is keeping those negative emotions, those negative feelings inside. We still go through the mental rehearsals. So you're driving into work and you go through, boy, I'm going to tell my boss this and that and this and that and this and that. And of course, you chicken out by the time you get to work. But you're going through it as if you really did it. All of the stress that you might have felt by actually confronting the person, you feel in the car on the way into work. Now, if you don't confront that person, that stress is still going to be there. And especially, we might add things like guilt. And later on, we come back and say, well, I should have said something and I didn't, or I feel bad because I'm supposed to defend myself and I can't. And those are some real issues for a lot of folks. Then we have the other side, where some people are just oblivious to their personal style and how it might affect other people. I know I myself have had an issue where I'm very assertive. A lot of my early experiences lead me to a career in public speaking. A lot of my early experiences lead me to the ability to debate and present my viewpoints. And sometimes I simply do it too strongly. And if I'm dealing with somebody who is not as assertive as I am, it's easy for me to run over them if I'm not really careful. And I have made that mistake in the past, and it's one of those where I have to be aware of it. If I am in a meeting with a bunch of people I don't know, it's very easy, if nobody takes control of the meeting early, it's very easy for me to start just slipping into that role. That's a personality style that sometimes is a benefit and sometimes can be a real problem. Now, the key for me is awareness. If I'm aware of my own style and I use it for the good of the group when it's appropriate, and I kind of hold back for the good of the group when it's important for other people to take a leadership role, then it can be a great ally for me. If I just kind of ignore my own perceptions, if I ignore other people's perceptions of my behavior, then I can get in a lot of trouble. And so those are the same kind of issues that everyone faces.
We're almost at our midpoint already with Tom Schenck from the Schenck Development Group. We're talking about workplace issues, ways that individuals and organizations can become more effective. And also, we're talking about this issue of balance between work and everything else and how we can all perhaps do better at that. If you would like to join our conversation, if you have questions, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455 and toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. One of the things that you mentioned was the the person driving into work rehearsing a confrontation, or at least a conversation they'd like to have, for example, with their boss, over an issue that they feel they need to address. And of course, one of the complicating factors in that is there's a power relationship there, and oftentimes people feel that maybe they're at jeopardy if they get a little bit too aggressive or express their point of view or experience any kind of conflict with their boss. And this is conflict with a boss is another area that I think a lot of us have a hard time with.
Well, I always think that it's a question of, do I know my boss well enough to confront? If you just simply rush in with a conflict with the idea that, oh, always expressing conflict is good, you're going to be in trouble with your boss or with anyone else. But if you know how to approach that person, even if there is a power relationship, you can minimize some of the problems with that. Now, of course, I think first thing you want to do is start off with a little risk assessment. A simple question to start off with is this issue really so big that I should be even bothering with it? It might be something you could just put away and just forget about, let it go. And sometimes that is the best move. It's the one that's the least effort, and it might be the right response for that situation. Sometimes it is appropriate to step up and maybe do some things. The next kind of style or strategy, just big picture, is simply to modify your own behavior. It's based on the idea that we really can't control other people, but we can influence their actions by changing our actions. I always suggest looking for the triggers. If you do something that makes your boss angry, if you stop doing that thing, maybe they won't get so angry at you. If there's something that really sets off your boss and makes them just react with anger or intimidation or whatever their negative style could be, well, you have to look for the triggers. And what are those triggers? And then avoid tripping them. And that's a great way to just start that assessment process. And those two strategies, they're low risk, and they're the things that are completely within your control. And from there, you then branch out to things that are a little bit more assertive.
We have a couple calls to talk with, and we could continue on that theme, but let's include them in our conversation. We'll go first to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I have a question that's sort of related to work and family in terms of when you're at that age and stage where not only do you have children to take care of, but there are elders in your family that need care and maintenance, which is comparable to the same degree of effort you have to put into children, how you manage to negotiate that at work, especially if it isn't a parent, but like an unmarried aunt or an uncle that never had children, so that you end up being the default setting, even though you're not, you know, immediate family. And I'll just listen.
Okay. Interesting question. And I think more and more people are experiencing some of those same issues. So this is going to be something that it's more important for us to deal with. I think when you're making any request at work, first of all, you have to treat it like a negotiation. And that means doing some real basic steps. First thing is you need to kind of analyze your case. What is it that you really need? And what is it that would be great if you can get it, your best case? And what would be really the minimum that you're asking for, your fallback position, as it were? And start off with just really analyzing that. The other thing is when you would go to your workplace and you want to make that request, hey, I need some extra time. I need flex time. I need to be able to maybe work at home for a day a week or something like that. Think about what's in it for them. What would be in it for your organization if they grant this to you? You know, it's that old everyone is tuned into the same radio station, WIIFM, what's in it for me? And that's something that I think we really have to acknowledge, even at work, that your boss is more willing to do things if you can show the benefit for your boss or for your team or for your organization. If you're just approaching it with, well, I need, that's going to be perceived as being selfish or disruptive or just irrelevant to what the boss is trying to accomplish. So those would be the kind of things that you'd want to think of right up front. You might think of things like, how will the organization fulfilling my request help me be more productive when I'm on the job? And if you can show that this little bit of flexibility on the organization's part will help me focus and really be there when I'm there, and I would be able to increase my productivity in this way, that's going to encourage them to say yes. If we're just coming at it from that point of view, well, I want this because I want this, that's a very easy thing to say no to when you're in the leadership position. So we want to treat it like a real negotiation. Then when you talk to the boss, is find out their perspectives. Find out what are some of the policies that already exist in your organization. Find out what kind of needs or concerns or pressures they're working under right now. And maybe there's a way to negotiate. You might not be able to get what you want now, but maybe in 2 months. You might be able to get it for most of the year, but not during those couple of months that are really busy. In other words, we really have to look for as many options as possible when you're trying to present this kind of very big life challenge. Chances are, if you're taking care of either a child or of an elder person in your life, it's going to be more than a couple of months issue. It's going to be a long-term issue. And so what we have to think of is long-term solutions. And it might be that we have to look at maybe even some other kinds of solutions. Maybe it's beyond just simple flex time or partly working at home. Maybe we need to look at job sharing. Maybe we need to look at other opportunities entirely because we need to find things that are going to work more with the realities that you're facing at home. So it's always thinking in terms of options and treating it like a real negotiation. What is it that you want, best case, worst case? What is it that you think getting what you want will help you improve your productivity? How is that going to happen? And why is it in the best interest of the organization to accommodate you? What are they going to gain from this kind of an arrangement? So those are some of the things that I would definitely start off with. But think long-term, think options. Those are really the keys.
Hope that helps with that question. We have another listener in Champaign to talk with. Let's do that. That's someone on line number two. Good morning.
Hi. It's good for you that you take my call. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question. It's sort of a legal question, maybe. I was wondering your advice about I was asked, I work at a company, and they asked me to go to a mandatory meeting for that is involving listening to a charity about, you know, giving to a charity. You were paid to go to the meeting, and you were also told that you didn't have to contribute, but you did have to go and listen. I was wondering, I was called insubordinate for not going to this, and I'm going to be talking to my boss and my HR person today about this, and I really don't want this on my record as being insubordinate because I think I was insubordinate for the right reasons. I thought that the charity should have been separate from my work. I don't think it had anything to do with my work, and so I just asked your advice on that.
That's interesting.
Well, that is. We haven't had that kind of a question before, so this is a challenge. You know, I think that, first of all, we'd have to look at that. Could an organization make that essentially an assignment for the day, a condition of employment for the day, just like, you know, you may not want to fill out that report for your expenses, but if that's the what they need to do their work, then that's a valid condition of employment or assignment for the day. Now, listening to a speech by a charity, that sounds extremely questionable to me. I would really ask them what's the business related reasoning behind this decision on their part to mandate that employees go. If they can make a valid business case, well, they've got a stronger argument in their favor. If they can't really make a valid business case, that is, going to this charity, going to listen to the speech about the charity is going to help you do your job better in some way. If they can't make that argument, they have less of a strong case. Now, on your side, I think before your meeting with your boss and the HR person today, you probably should sit down and write out your side of the story. Here are the reasons why I didn't feel that I should go. This took me away from these job priorities that my boss has already said are important. This prevented me from getting my normal work done. This prevented me from serving X customers or accomplishing these tasks and so on. So really list out and try to document that. I would go ahead and maybe suggest just writing down for your own benefit, first of all, what exactly is the big issue for you? Why is even going to listen a concern for you? How does that kind of play into it? Just to clarify your own thoughts. You may not share with that with them in the end, but just to clarify your thoughts. Certainly one thing you should request is you need a formal written statement from them about why you're getting this reprimand, why you're getting this note that something was wrong here in your performance because you didn't want to go. Being called insubordinate is something significant enough where they need to justify that and it needs to be documented. Now, anything that they write down, you have a right to put in your permanent personnel file a rebuttal. So whatever they write down, you can then write a careful, well-thought-out, well-planned response to that too. I might even suggest, you know, this is something you may want to talk to a lawyer about it. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give you the full legal perspective here. But generally speaking, organizations are not really allowed to mandate charitable responses. A good example are the United Way drives that have been going on for decades now. Organizations can't really mandate that each employee has to give a certain amount of money for this. You know, that's not really the way it's supposed to work. So it sounds a little bit dicey to me that they could mandate you go to this meeting, especially if it doesn't have a direct business purpose. So that would be the initial thought that I'd have. You may want to talk to a lawyer about this one, though.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, good luck with that. Interesting case.
Yeah. Well, we have just about maybe 15 minutes left with our guest Tom Schenck from the Schenck Development Group, and we're talking about a variety of workplace issues. If you'd like to join our conversation in the time remaining, the number around Champaign-Urbana again, 333-9455, toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, we could take off in any direction here, but I had a number of questions. That last call kind of made me realize that not everyone has the kind of power relations that with their bosses that, you know, certainly have been my experience in the last few years, and I would, especially in an academic community, I think people are a little bit less formal in their, you know, that's certainly not universally true even mm-hmm. in a university setting. There are a wide range of sort of workplace cultures that we find ourselves in.
Well, you know, I think one of the key things that I see when I work with organizations is a lot of times it's just that employees don't know what their rights are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times employees have more rights than they think. We have a right to be treated with respect. We have a right to be treated in a way that is legally sound. We have a right to see things in writing if it's going to be – if it somehow affects a decision about our job mm-hmm. or our job performance. So – if somebody's not happy with our performance, and I guess I just worked with somebody recently where they did not get a performance appraisal for years, and all of a sudden they got a very bad one, and what it turns out is that they were being forced out, and it was an unhealthy situation. The employee did not realize they had more rights in this case than they thought. And I think those are some of the issues that employees just need to be more aware of what their rights are. And there's lots of good resources out there. I don't want to suggest that we need to run to a lawyer every time there's a problem. I also don't want to suggest that you know, should always play hardball with your boss. But if you don't understand what is going on with your performance, if you don't understand why your boss is angry at you, if your boss just says something like, well, do better, you have a right to ask, tell me what you mean by that. Give me specific feedback. Let me know exactly what the issue is. What specific action steps do you need me to take to improve? And when will we monitor those action steps? When will we reevaluate to see if I am making improvements? What tools do I need to be able to improve? We have a right to ask for those sorts of things. I think that the balance of power is actually much more equal than we usually think. Certainly the boss can make assignments. That's true. But as long as we're always working toward improving our own level of expertise, as long as we're always working towards serving the customer the way the company says they want the customer served, as long as we're working to support whatever the organizational values are, and we can demonstrate those kinds of things, we've got a much stronger case, and the balance of power is much more equal. Fact is that there's a lot of people, though, who don't believe that they're really being managed effectively. I just saw a report from the American Psychological Association in their journal, The Monitor. It said that 60%, 60 to 75% of employees felt their boss was incompetent. Now, to me, that's astonishing. I'm a little surprised. I think that's a little high. Mm-hmm. But the point is, a lot of us don't really have a lot of confidence in the person we report to or upper management. And I always really want to start off with that idea that the best thing that you can do on the job to get a better sense of who you are and what's going on is to start with that relationship with your boss. Work to improve that. Understand what that person's goals are. Understand what their priorities are. Watch their reactions. Every day you're getting information about what your boss does and does not like. And the question you have to ask is, are you doing more of the things that they like or more of the things they dislike? I have several dogs, and if one of the dogs doesn't like to be rubbed the wrong way, and every time I rub her the wrong way, she bites me. Well, you know what? There's a certain point when I have to take responsibility for getting bit. And on the job, we often don't do that. We say things like, well, that's not fair. They shouldn't act like that. Well, the fact is that people do act unfairly, and sometimes we have to deal with the reality that life is sometimes unfair. Now, the good news is that doesn't mean we have to give up. What it does mean is that we have to take responsibility for our own actions and influence the situation through changing our own behavior, and sometimes directly confronting some of the behaviors of those people who we report to.
Well, see, this is an interesting area. You mentioned this survey that shows a lot of people, you know, give very bad marks to their managers or their bosses. And I wonder to what extent we have, you know, the art of management has sort of, you know, I mean, it's changed over the years. Our ideas about effective management, we had, well, back when I was studying organizational management, there was this, you know, the theory X boss, which was, you know, essentially rewards and punishment. You do this, every detail, I will tell you how to perform and so forth. And then there's theory Y, which was the more collegial, you know, sort of family. We're all in this together. Everyone is, you know, responsible to make good decisions on his or her own. And the manager is there to facilitate rather than boss people around. But I'm not sure that either of those models is really relevant or practiced in the workplace these days. And sometimes I wonder if management is an art that we haven't paid much attention to recently.
It's a frustrating thing for me because part of my work is working with supervisors and leaders at all levels and helping them see there's some different ways to do things. I think the theory X, theory Y from McGregor is exactly the problem in that people think it's an either-or choice. Either I have to be a hard-nosed, by-the-book enforcer, and I guess nobody's going to like me, or, you know, I can be everybody's pal, and it could be like a family environment, and everybody is happy, you know, but maybe I'm going to have to sacrifice productivity. Well, those are really stilted ways to look at management and leadership. Fact is that you can focus very strongly on the bottom line, on getting work done, on productivity, on meeting standards, and having very high standards, and taking care of people so that people feel comfortable. That's, I think, one of the big challenges. Some of the research showing the Gen Xers entering the workforce and even the next generation, some people are calling them millennials, but whatever you want to call them, their needs and their work styles are very different from the baby boomers and the generation that followed them. that's a real challenge for a lot of managers because we just get used to managing a certain way, and we forget that we have to change with the style. Ken Blanchard and some of the other folks that he's worked with has come up with this notion years ago called situational leadership. Now, some people kind of look at that like situational ethics. Oh, that means you really have no ethics. It's not really that sort of thing. It's simply saying that you have to meet people where they are. And if I have a brand new employee who it doesn't really know a lot about what's going on in this workplace, I have to be more directive with that person. And I have to really focus on standards and very simple step-by-step instructions and have a very tight set of guidelines on that person because they don't know any better. But if I try to manage somebody who's been around for 20 years in that same style, it's going to be really a problematic situation. And we want to avoid using the same style on every single person. That, I think, in essence, is one of the keys to good leadership. I know in classes over and over again, one of my little mottos is hard on standards and soft on people. And you can do that. One of the things that we are finding these days is that some of the most well-respected leaders are very good at balancing, having very high standards, holding people ruthlessly accountable to those high standards, giving them the tools that they need to accomplish those high standards, and getting out of their way. And at the same time, they can take care of people. I don't know if they'd ever want to pal around with them and be a counselor and those sorts of things, but there's other folks that do that. But when I say take care of people, is recognize that we're all carrying a stressful load. The society is moving faster than it was 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. And if we're going to keep the best people, and retention is still a big issue in a lot of the organizations that I'm working with, the economy may be turning south. It may not be. People are still differing on this. But we're still focusing on keeping good employees. And the only way you do that is by establishing positive as well as productive relationships with them. Most people out there will probably find that the reason why people leave their work is not because they don't like the work or because the goals were too hard, but it's because they think their boss is a jerk or they think their coworkers don't care or they don't like their customers. In other words, it's the people issue. So if we can take care of the people issue, we're going to be much more likely to keep our best employees. One of the big problems is that a lot of managers never get any training. They never get any training that's going to help them look at some of their own behaviors as managers, to look at the consequences of their behaviors as managers. When I'm an individual employee, my behavior affects me, and I can either live or die based on my own productivity. When I'm a manager, if I supervise 10 people, my behavior doesn't just affect me, but it affects those other 10 as well. And that can be a huge plus if we're managing effectively, and it can be a huge minus to the organization's bottom line if we're managing ineffectively. And I bet everyone out there has got a couple of good, juicy examples of each.
As someone who is not a manager, but who is affected by management, what are some of the things we can do to make that relationship, healthier, more productive? How can we, free ourselves from bad management and try to establish a good pattern?
This is an issue that just comes up over and over and over again. I think a couple of very simple keys. One is that suggestion I made before of you got to read your boss. You've got to look at the signs. Look at the things that set them off. Look at the things that please them every day in their communication. They're emphasizing some things and they're de-emphasizing others. There might be some parts of your organization's mission or purpose or goals that they talk about a lot and other parts they ignore. Well, this gives you valuable clues as to what they value and what they don't value. That's going to help you focus your efforts every day. One of the big things is just keeping the communication happening. And a lot of the problems in organizations are a question of unclear expectations, unclear priorities, unclear assumptions that each has about the other. So a lot of the things that I talk about in some of my workings with organizations really boils down to improving two-way communication between the employee and the boss. Sometimes it's as simple as completing a monthly activity report. Every month, I recommend this all the time to people, and no matter what their level in an organization, you should go ahead and do a quick little summary of what are some of the big accomplishments that you've had in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Bullet points. I heard recently somebody phrase that the 15-by-5 rule should take you no longer than 15 minutes to write and your boss no longer than 5 minutes to read. That in and of itself will make sure that your boss knows what you're doing. One of the biggest problems that bosses have is they're just not around, and they don't know what their employees are doing, and they're afraid to ask. So this is a way for you to keep your boss informed. Another very simple suggestion that many people just don't think of on their own is to meet with your boss periodically. Every other week is a good time frame. Once a month, some people prefer a good focused meeting. And you might have a very simple agenda for this standard, preset, periodic meeting. It might start off with something as simple as sharing good news. What were some of the successes since our last meeting? What were some of the things I've accomplished? What were some of the goals I've achieved? You might go ahead and talk about progress reports on current work in progress, things that are going on right now that they should know about. Remember that no boss likes to be surprised. And one of the big problems is that a lot of times we don't want to share the bad news, so we end up surprising the boss, and then we wonder why they're upset. Well, this is the big issue we've got to overcome. Then you might solve some problems. Any future problems you know are coming up on the horizon, any possible problems that might prevent you from doing your work, do a little brainstorming with the boss. Then you might go ahead and start planning and prioritizing for the next couple of weeks between now and your next meeting with your boss. And then finally, put any issues that need to go on to the next meeting's agenda. So five little points there. You might go ahead and spend 15 minutes every other week. You might spend 30 minutes or 20 minutes every month just simply having that little meeting. And that in and of itself is going to help make sure that you're always on track. One of the things that I'm really surprised at when I work with people in organizations is how seldom people really understand what their boss expects from them. There was a great study by the American Management Association where they asked 1,000 supervisors, what's your employee's job? Then they asked those employees, what's your job? And there was agreement only 23% of the time. And that means 77% of the time the employee did not know what their job was. And that is a problem. Employees don't always ask, and supervisors don't always tell. Well, we have to get away from that don't ask, don't tell policy. We have to know what the expectations are. And Stephen Covey had said that 85% of problems in relationships come from unclear expectations. And I really see that every day with some of the clients that I work with. If you just simply clarify your expectations and the priorities, you're on the road to a much healthier relationship with your supervisor.
We have 2 minutes left and a caller waiting. Let's squeeze them in the time we have, and we'll have to try to be quick, though. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
I just was listening to your program, and I came in a little late, but you're talking about golden expectations. And
sure.
I'm no longer in this situation, but I was working in a situation where the goals and expectations changed. Apparently, the supervisor wasn't totally aware of the goals and expectations and would change them constantly. In addition, the supervisor and I were at odds. I mean, if we looked at, the please understand me personality categories, we were almost at extreme opposite corners.
Mm-hmm.
And what I finally wound up doing was transferring to another division within the same company, and there I had thrived. But, not everybody can have that luxury of changing. What do you recommend people to do when there's definitely a personality clash, definitely the expectation issues? Like, for instance, I was meeting what the upper management wanted, but I wasn't meeting what the supervisor wanted.
Uh-huh.
And it was just incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
And then finally the supervisor said, well, you should be doing, I finally went and did what the supervisor wanted me to do. And then he turns around and says, well, you should be doing this. And, it was almost an explosion.
I hate to say this, we have about half a minute.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll
get
off.
That's all right. Thanks for the question. Yeah.
And the issues you brought up are so common that it's scary in a lot of ways. First thing, kudos for firing your boss. You transferred to another department or division, and that was actually equivalent of firing your boss. Sometimes that is the right choice. But one of the things that I always recommend in the kind of example you brought up, you've got to document. When your boss says this is what you need to do, you've got to write that down. Mm-hmm. If nothing else, keep it for your own personal files.
Yeah.
But certainly you might send it back to the boss as a confirmation. Another quick suggestion is every time you get a new priority, you spread out your other priorities on the table and you say, okay, here's your new priority. Boss, where does this fit in with the other ones you've already given me?
Yeah.
And that is their job, to help you reprioritize that. If they don't want to do that, well, that's where you document. Boss, this is the priority I'm going to do it in because you're not going to help me out. Here is my prioritization. And if you disagree, send a note back to me. If you don't, I'm just going to go ahead and act as is.
Okay.
So those are some quick possibilities, at least.
Hope that helps, and I'm sorry to say that we're out of time here. There's much more we could discuss, and I'm sure we'll do this again. Our guest has been Tom Schenck from the Schenck Development Group in Champaign, and thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. It's fun as always.
All right.